Good evening and thank you for coming. My name is Jeff Miller. I'm the new branch chief for Diablo Canyon in the USNRC's Region 4 office. This evening we're conducting a public exit meeting with Pacific Gas and Electric to discuss the results of the special inspection that was conducted at the end of last year involving the emergency core cooling system. For the members of the public who are in attendance at the meeting tonight, the NRC staff will be available after the meeting to answer questions after the business portion of the meeting, but before the meeting is adjourned. I'd like to mention this is the NRC meeting for folks who had the estate planning meeting. That's next door down the hall, so make sure everybody's in the right place. In order that we may answer as many of your questions as possible this evening, we have provided index cards to you. We ask that you write your questions down on the index cards, and if we don't have the time or the expertise to get to them tonight, we will get back with you with answers to your questions, so please ensure that you have a contact information, a name, telephone number, or email on that card so that we can get back in touch with you. In light of the recent earthquakes at Humboldt Bay and in Haiti, we do know there will be a lot of questions involving seismic activity. We do have, or actually we will have, Dr. Annie Kammerer, one of our seismic experts, will be on the phone during the question and answer period to provide some limited answers on seismic issues. I also know license renewal has been a topic of much discussion lately. In order to meet our goals, we'd appreciate that. And with that, I'll now turn the meeting over to Mr. Michael Runyon, who is the team leader for the special inspection.
Okay, we will now present the results of the NRC special inspection into the disabled emergency core cooling system interlocks. Our agenda for this meeting will be to introduce the NRC staff. We'll also give a chance for Pacific Gas and Electric to introduce their staff. We will describe the condition that existed. We will present the findings that we had. We will have a discussion about the licensee's root cause analysis, and then we will answer questions from the public. My name is Michael Runyon. I was the team leader for this inspection. I am a senior reactor analyst. Also on the team was Dr. Michael Peck, who's a senior resident inspector at Diablo Canyon. Paul Elkman, who's a senior emergency preparedness inspector. He was on the team but is not present tonight. And Megan Williams, a reactor inspector. Other NRC staff present at this meeting are Troy Pruitt, the Deputy Director of the Division of Reactor Safety, Jeff Miller, who's the Chief of Reactor Projects Branch B, Tony Brown, who's the Resident Inspector at Diablo Canyon, Victor Drix, who's a Senior Public Affairs Officer, Laura Uselding, who's a Public Affairs Officer, and Annie Kammerer, who is a Senior Seismologist, and she will be on the phone tonight. I'll now turn it over to Pacific Gas and Electric.
Thank you. So we'll just take a minute to introduce ourselves. I'll start off. I am Jim Becker. I am the Site Vice President at Diablo Canyon Power Plant.
I'm Ken Peters. I'm the Station Director at Diablo Canyon.
Susan Westcott. I'm the Engineering Director at Diablo Canyon.
We performed a special inspection for this event because of two reasons. First of all, it involved the loss of capability to activate a key safety system from the control room. And also, our initial estimate of risk indicated that there was a risk significance to the event. And these two factors were used to make a determination to perform a special inspection instead of just performing our routine inspection. We were on site doing this inspection between November 30th and December 3rd of last year, and we also performed some additional inspection after these dates. We expect that our inspection report will be issued in late February. At this time, I will turn it over to Dr. Peck to discuss a description of the condition.
My name is Michael Peck. I'm one of the two inspectors that are permanently assigned at the Diablo Canyon plant. And as Mr. Runyon indicated, I had an opportunity to participate in this special inspection. And what I'd like to do, what I would like to do is start off with a general description of the condition. And in order to do this, I'd like to focus first on how the emergency core cooling system would normally operate, how this condition, the failed interlocks, may have prevented it to function fully as designed, about the conditions that led up to the degraded condition. Now, this is a picture of a typical Westinghouse reactor coolant system that you'd find at a plant similar to Diablo Canyon. And just as for background general information, the reactor core sits here in the reactor vessel. Pressurized water is flown through the core from the reactor pressure vessel into one of four steam generators. These steam generators are basically U-tube heat exchangers. Now, water from the secondary side of the plant is pumped into the steam generators and allowed to boil. And that water is turned to steam, and that's the steam that actually drives the turbine generators and produces electricity at the plant. After the pressurized reactor coolant has given up its heat to boil the water, it comes back, exits the steam generators, goes through a reactor coolant pump, then back into the reactor vessel, and then back to the core to repeat the cycle. Now, the reactor coolant system, as you see here, is actually nestled inside a steel-lined reinforced concrete containment structure. Now, the reactor coolant system is made up of lots of welded piping connections. These pipes range in size from about a 1-inch diameter up to the largest pipe, which is a crossover piping here, which is a 31-inch diameter. Before the Nuclear Regulatory Commission will license a plant to operate, such as Diablo Canyon, they require the licensees to demonstrate that the core can be maintained cooled in the unlikely event that any pipe in the reactor cooling system should break. Now, this regulatory requirement is implemented in part by what we call the emergency core cooling system. Photograph of a typical motor-operated valve in a nuclear application. Just from a way of background, there's a process path here of process fluid that comes through a pipe, through the valve disc and body here, and then up through the continuation through that particular process pipe. Connected to that valve disc is a stem. And this stem, wrong button. This stem extends up through a valve operator. This is what's called a motor operator for a valve. Now, this motor operator can be operated or change the position of the valve in one of two modes. Typically, what happens is a control room operator will push a button on the control board, which will send an electric signal to energize a motor. And that motor, through a series of gears, will cause the stem and the attached valve disc to be pulled up out of the valve, up into the section of the operator. Now, the valve can also be operated manually. In this case, an operator, a person, can come down to the valve, disengage the electric motor system by this clutch lever, and then change the position of the valve by the use of this hand wheel. So let's talk a little bit more about the emergency core cooling system. If we have a postulated accident, if we say that one of the pipes within the reactor coolant system should rupture, we would expect reactor coolant to exit the reactor coolant system and then collect in the floor of the containment. The emergency core cooling system will automatically start to mitigate this particular event. And what happens is, very basically, is these pumps will start and they'll pull transfer water from the reactor water storage tank into the reactor to cool the core, and then that water will eventually leak out into the containment. Now, there becomes a point when the reactor water storage tank becomes depleted. And this may happen anywhere between 20 minutes and several hours into the event, depending upon the size of the pipe rupture. Prior to the depletion of this tank, the control room operators are expected to take action to realign the emergency core cooling system from this cold leg injection mode to the cold leg recirculation mode. And this takes a number of valve repositionings using these remote manual motor operated valves. One of the first things that the operator does is open up the containment sump valve, which is located here. Once the containment sump valve is fully open, the water that's came out of the reactor break that's collected in the sump can now be rerouted back through a low head pump, cooled through a heat exchanger, and then pumped back into the core. One of the subsequent steps for the operator to perform is to open the discharge from the heat exchanger valve. That's shown right here. And what that does is it allows cooled water that came from the reactor leak to be routed back to the other two emergency core cooling pumps. Now, in this particular condition that was discovered by Pacific Gas and Electric back in fall of 2009, involved the interaction between these two valves. The sump valve has an interlock with the heat exchanger valve. In order for the heat exchanger valve to be operated electrically, the sump valve has to be fully open. During testing during the refueling outage, Pacific Gas and Electric identified that this interaction didn't operate. So in this case, the end result would be that plant operators would have to go locally, disengage that clutching mechanism, and reposition that this particular valve locally by turning the hand wheel. So let's talk a little bit about how the situation occurred. And this condition really has its roots from a problem that was identified at another plant very similar to Diablo Canyon. In this case, plant engineers had found under certain very specific conditions that this line coming from the valve here can pressurize. And it can pressurize to the point where the valve operator, the motor operator, is not strong enough to be able to open the valve because of the pressure against it. So this bit of information was transmitted to all the plants within the nuclear community through what we call operational experience. Pacific Gas and Electric received this information back around 2005 and took a two-tiered approach to address this concern. The first approach was to modify their emergency instructions. And this modification basically had control room operators establish cooling to this heat exchanger earlier than what they would have otherwise. And by adding cooling to this heat exchanger, what that did is limit the potential for this line to pressurize as much as it potentially could. But is that it had to go from the full closed to the full open position in basically less than 25 seconds. And after the valve was modified, it was tested as part of the post-modification process, and the testing engineer identified that it didn't meet this acceptance criteria. So what normally would happen is this discrepancy would go back into the corrective action program and be inputted back into the design process. In this case, that didn't happen. The valve engineer determined that he could take some action to reduce the valve stroke without having to go back through the formal design process. Now, to talk about that, I have to provide just a little bit more detail on this. When a control room operator presses open the button switch to open the valve, that electrically energizes the motor, and the gear set starts to turn around and the valve stem comes open. If you notice here, there's an intersection, there's a gear that basically is connected to what we call the valve rotors. Now, there's this particular valve has four rotors. This is a picture of the rotors here. And those rotors spin proportional to the number of times that the gears in the valve spin. Now, rotor number one, in this case, basically counts the number of spins that the motor stays energized. So it controls the amount of time or the distance that the valve actually strokes by counting the revolutions of the gear set. And so what the engineer did is he reset the switch that would turn off the valve motor. Now, rotor number three is another set of interlocks. And rotor number three is in part of the electrical circuit that allows the operator to open that other valve, the one that comes off of the heat exchanger. So for the system to operate properly, the contacts on rotor three, and we call it switches, but the contacts on rotor three must engage before the contacts on rotor one stop the valve movement. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Mr. Runyon. He's going to talk about our findings.
The inspection team identified three violations of NRC requirements in the areas of design control, test control, and safety evaluations. As Dr. Peck mentioned, the licensee made an adjustment to rotor 1. When they made this adjustment, they did not use their design change procedures as they were required to do. And because of this, we identified a violation in the area of design control. When the adjustment was made to rotor 1, it affected the operation of rotor 3. And in fact, rotor 3 no longer worked, and that's the reason why they couldn't open the valves from the control room. The licensee did not perform any test after they made the adjustment to rotor 1 to ensure that rotor 3 was still working properly. And because of this, we identified a violation in the area of test control. Dr. Peck also mentioned that the licensee made a change to an emergency operating procedure for operators to direct cooling water to this heat exchanger, the RHR heat exchanger. When they made this change to the emergency operating procedure, they were required to do an evaluation to determine if prior NRC approval was required. This evaluation was not performed, and because of this, we identified a violation in the area of safety evaluations. As I mentioned earlier, our original estimate showed that we had an increase in risk, and that was partly the reason we decided to do a special inspection instead of doing a routine inspection. The information we gathered from this inspection was used to refine our risk estimate. And this new information suggested that the risk was less than what we originally thought. And the violations were determined to be of very low significance. The valves that could not be operated from the control room could have been operated by sending operators to the valves to open them using the manual hand wheels. There were emergency operating procedures available to the operators that clearly told them what to do if these valves failed to open. It told them immediately to go out into the plant and open these valves locally. And the operators were well trained on these procedures. The access to the valves was unobstructed, and the valves themselves were easy to operate. They were out in the open. The hand wheels were at about shoulder height. And if an accident had occurred, the predicted radiation levels at the valves would have been less severe than what is considered a limit for this operation. In other words, the radiation levels would have been low enough for operators to go out there and perform these actions. Also, the temperature, Dr. Peck, to discuss the root cause analysis.
When a special inspection team is sent out from the region, it includes a charter, and that charter lists specific items that the team needs to evaluate as part of the inspection. One of the items that the team was tasked with was to evaluate the Pacific Aston Electric root cause and extend a condition review. Now, when the team was on site, the root cause had been completed, but it had not been approved by the oversight function. And then after the team left, the root cause report was in fact revised to include additional root causes. So these comments are basically directed at the root cause evaluation that was available to the team at the time. The licensee identified two root causes. The first is that the valve testing procedure did not include guidance for coordinating the limit switch changes. And this is focused on the testing procedure, the maintenance procedure that verifies that the valve doesn't do the things that it was supposed to. And what Pacific Gas and Electric is basically saying is they're presented an opportunity to have caught this particular problem prior to the valve being put into service in February 2008. The second root cause has to do with the design control process. If you recall, when we were talking about the original change out of the gears, had that design process been correct in order to establish that the valve could operate or stroke within that 25-second stroke time, then these other particular problems wouldn't have manifested itself. That would have solved the problem initially without challenging additional modifications to the system. So as the team evaluated the root cause, we felt that there were some opportunities for improvement. And basically, one of the concerns that we had is the root cause team focused on the valve and rotor coordination as a maintenance activity. Now, when we think of maintenance activity, at least in the nuclear business, maintenance activity is to restore a particular configuration to what's specified in the design. In this case, there was an actual design change that bypassed the design control process. So when the maintenance engineers, the valve test engineers, were performing this test, they would not have been authorized to reset the rotors outside of that was already specified by the design documents. So our view was that the focus on maintenance as opposed to the design control process resulted in a less than full evaluation of the underlying conditions. Also, as a result of the focus on maintenance, the team felt that the extent of condition could have been improved also. The team had identified that after the modifications had been completed, that the subsequent position, limit switch position on rotor 1, did not result in the valve stem and the disc being fully withdrawn from the process flow path. So I'd like to just close with a summary. And this is a summary of the NRC's findings. First off, Pacific Gas and Electric identified an adverse condition which had the potential of adversely affecting the certain design functions of the emergency core cooling system. The NRC responded to this condition by sending out a special inspection team. This special inspection team identified 3 violations of NRC requirements and some improvement opportunities in the root cause evaluation process. But in the end, after the extensive review of this particular condition, the NRC concluded that this particular problem had a very low safety significance. And with that, we'll turn it over to Mr. Becker.
Thank you. Well, the first point, the three of us are going to make some brief statements here to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The first thing that I want to state is that we take this issue very seriously. When we identified this issue, and as you know, we identified it during our last refueling outage as a result of some testing we were doing, some equipment testing. When we identified the issue, we promptly reported it to the industry and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and I immediately convened an integrated response team to investigate the issue and make sure we fully understood it. We actually pulled some of our folks off of refueling outage assignments, which are very important, and put them on this because I made this the top priority at the site. So we do take the issue very seriously. It was as a result of that investigation that we validated the ability of our operators to handle the event, and Ken Peters will provide more detail about that. And
our ability of our actual operators to go to the valve and operate it locally. So that gives us the confidence that locally we could have operated the valve and the overall system function would have been met. And Susan Westcott will talk about the root cause.
Thanks, Ken. We are committed to ensuring that this doesn't happen again. We have done a review of all the maintenance that was done on valves during the outage, and we've ensured that any associated rotor adjustments have been done properly, and they have been tested appropriately. We finished our root cause, and we are changing our maintenance procedures to ensure that if we do a limit switch adjustment, that it does have the associated rotor adjustment. And we've also ensured that the appropriate design modification process is used, and then it'll drive the independent technical review from there. Thanks.
Thanks, Jim, for your comments. I just want to provide a couple of concluding remarks, and then I'll turn it back over to Jeff to wrap up the business portion of the meeting. First off, I want to thank Mike and Michael. I think they did a very thorough independent inspection. They served the NRC well in their review of this issue. It was very challenging, and they sacrificed personally to come out to Diablo and review this issue for the region. I do believe that Diablo Canyon needs to focus on their modification process and they need to focus on field changes that occur during maintenance activities. So it sounds like the actions you're taking are going to appropriately address those areas. And I do want to emphasize that we did a pretty thorough risk assessment, safety assessment of the underlying safety significance, and we did conclude that this was a low safety significant issue, primarily based on our assessment that the operators would be highly successful in opening the valves to restore cooling back to the emergency core cooling system. So, Jeff, with that, I'll turn it over to you to wrap up the business portion.
This concludes the business portion of the meeting. We will take a brief break here to collect the question cards, give us a chance to go through the cards, and also we're going to get Dr. Annie Kammerer on the phone. And we'll take a 10-minute break here while we put that together, and we'll reconvene at that point for a question and answer period. And restrooms are down the hall here to the right, and meet back here in 10 minutes.
Excuse me, I think we're going to go ahead and get started now. This is a little bit different.
Whoa.
This is a little bit different than we've done our annual town hall style meetings. So in this case, we're collecting questions from the public, from the audience, that the inspection team and the NRC personnel are going to respond to. Now, once they've gone through those, the note cards with the questions, and if you continue to have questions, please fill them out, raise your hand. Megan will keep picking them up, and we'll keep trying to answer those questions. Now, once they've gone through all the note cards, we will open it up to additional comments or questions, and that'll be more like what we've done for the town hall style meetings. Once we get to that portion, just raise your hand. I'll come to you with the microphone. I ask you to state your name, your affiliation, if any. Please keep your comments, questions.
To safely operate without negative incidents during a Richter 9.0 earthquake, the intensity of which has occurred in this area every 150 to 180 years.
To my knowledge, that has not, someone can speak to the plant side of it, but to my knowledge, that has not been analyzed for the reason that the tectonic regime around the plant is not capable of a magnitude 9. I'm unaware of a magnitude 9 occurring in that area, so I would ask that maybe a follow-up question clarify that. But whenever you're looking at seismic hazards, you have to keep two things in mind, the location and the distance, as well as the return period of interest. And so What we've done is we've looked at the locations of the actual faults, the capability of the faults, and the distance to the plant, and analyzed those scenarios for the shaking hazard at the plant. Based on that work that's been done and work which we will continue to do in an ongoing way as we continue to get information from the USGS CRADA, the plant has been assessed to be safe for the shaking levels which are possible given the faulting offshore and onshore.
Okay, thanks, Annie. The next one, also seismic related, is for you. It involves the shoreline fault. Would a seismic event of the postulated shoreline fault affect and trigger a co-event with the Hosgree fault?
That is currently being work on that area is currently being wrapped up. They're looking at the state-of-the-art methodology which is used to make the assessment with regard to the potential for co-seismic events. That has not been found to be a credible scenario. So the two events are being assessed separately because the stress on one of the faults would not be triggering stresses on the other fault such that they would rupture together. However, there is also ongoing work related to the region in which a possible extension of the shoreline fault meets the Hosgree fault, and that is being assessed. And shaking, given that scenario, does not exceed the design level of the plants as represented by the long-term, the LTSP spectrum.
Okay, thanks. The next question in the seismic area involves the license renewal somewhat. And just as a reminder, there is a public meeting coming up in the near future to talk about license renewal activities in more detail. But this particular question, the shoreline fault has not been studied thoroughly. PG&E, in its application for license renewal, says as much. They use terms preliminary, initial, current level of uncertainty. How is the NRC viewing the significance of this fault at present?
Well, the NRC is continuing, of course, to look at all of the data as it comes in and has also performed an independent investigation with the preliminary data, which is detailed in a research information letter, which is publicly available, RIL09001. Currently, the NRC considers this an active fault and has been assessing it as such. In that regard, we take it very seriously, and we are assessing it at this point as an active fault. The work that's being done with the USGS CRADA continues to be ongoing, and a significant amount of work has been done to this point, such that with each new piece of information, the uncertainty in terms of the capability of the fault, the location of the fault, the potential impact to the plant is being significantly reduced. All seismic hazard parameters and analysis methods have inherent uncertainty for a variety of reasons. One thing is, even if you know all the parameters of the fault, there's still some uncertainty in terms of future ruptures, when they would occur, how big they would be. For that reason, we're looking at sort of maximum conservative estimations as we look at both determine both the parameters as well as the analysis methods we're using. We're basically using very conservative parameters and methods will be brought into broader analyses of the regional tectonics and the regional hazard, which would also potentially impact Diablo Canyon.
Okay, thank you. We had three comment cards which involve the same type of question. Essentially, it tries to correlate an earthquake event with the condition that was inspected as part of the special inspection. earthquake events, of course, the NRC evaluates those. Under a maximum probable earthquake type scenario, the plants are designed to withstand that maximum probable earthquake. As a result, we do not expect an earthquake to cause a loss of coolant accident at the facility. So this type of condition that we evaluated is for a different accident type. That it's an accident type which results in a breakage of reactor coolant system piping. And again, the earthquake event does not cause a breakage of the reactor coolant system piping. Andy, do you want to add to that?
No, I work on the hazard side, and I leave the plant analysis to you.
And then, Annie, I think this is the last seismic question I have on a note card, is will the final analysis due this year also include 3D mapping?
Yes, in the sense that there are a number of the techniques that are being used currently provide 3D information. There is a variety of geophysical methods which are available to basically look at the surface and into the earth, and a wide variety of the geophysical methods available are being used right now. There has been some discussion with regard to 3D seismic, and there's some indication that some of the 3D seismic techniques are not making it, can't make it into the Franciscan Formation. However, sub-bottom profiling, seismic reflection, and other geophysical methods are also being undertaken and are providing a subsurface view of the offshore region. And so what we do when we undertake these studies is we take the complete data set of all geophysical methods, seismicity, aeromagnetics, sub-bottom profiling, 3D, topographic bathymetry, and we take all of this together and assess them as one large data set, which are each giving us different views of the same picture. And using all of that information together, we can develop a tectonic model of the offshore region. So we do have basically enough information to develop a 3D model of of the offshore region, including the uncertainties, which are then also folded into the analysis.
Okay, thank you. That was the last comment card I had on seismic issues. Again, we wanted to focus mainly on the topics and questions concerning the special inspection. So with that, I'm going to let Annie go back to sleep. And if you have other questions regarding seismic topics, just put them on a comment card. We'll collect those and we'll pass those on to Annie, and she can provide her response back.
Would Annie be the one to ask about a tsunami before she goes? Would that be a seismic?
Annie, do you have a background to address tsunamis?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question, but yes, I do.
Okay.
There was a tsunami.
I'm sorry, I didn't get on a microphone for
okay.
Our,
all right. Okay.
I can't hear that what's being said.
Just a second, Annie.
Oh, do you want? Yeah, we had a devastating tsunami, more than one in the recent past, in 1907 in Sunset Palisades, which is immediately adjoining the plant location, and that destroyed a brand new refinery in 1907, and it's not widely realized, apparently. There was one that destroyed Havilah in 1878. And my question is, since it's this seismic business, that's the terrorist I'm most concerned with is Mother Nature, especially in light of the events of the last 2 weeks. So that's, if she has expertise in that area.
I didn't mean to interrupt, I was writing the question.
Okay, well, why don't you go ahead and write the question down, and we'll get back to you. I want to make sure we get an informed answer back to you.
The tsunami.
Right.
The plant is not the safety systems are designed such that they're on the dry side of the plant. So in any type of natural hazard assessment and risk review, what you do is you look at the hazard, and then you look at the potential hazard on the plant in terms of the risk of the facility. Assessment has been done for Diablo Canyon looking at the hazard, which has determined a flood level from a tsunami. Diablo Canyon is basically on the dry side of the tsunami hazard assessment. So the plant is designed for tsunami in the sense that it's raised to the point where it's out of the flood zone. In terms of the shoreline fault, we also did some work to review what that meant in terms of the tsunami hazard. And what was determined is because basically the fault is a pier strike slip fault, it is not capable of generating a tsunami which is greater than that for which the plant's already been assessed.
Okay, thanks, Annie. We're going to let you go.
Great, thank you very much. And if people have questions, please write them in a card, and I'll be happy to respond to any of them, hopefully after a little bit of sleep.
Okay. All right, good night.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Michael, I'm going to give the next question to you. It involves essentially the operating experience. The individual would like a little more discussion on what plant had the similar construction to Diablo Canyon that had the situation, and what happened to that information, where did it end up, and why wasn't a proactive approach taken to prevent the same thing from happening?
Well, I think I can answer that. The original event happened at a plant in Rock Hill, South Carolina, called Catawba. A similar plant to, very similar, there's a little bit of differences, but a similar plant to Diablo Canyon. This particular condition was applicable to most Westinghouse designs, and the operational experience was disseminated through the industry very, very quickly. I can speak on two other plants that I have personal familiarity with, Wolf Creek in Burlington, Kansas, and Callaway in Columbia, Missouri, Fulton, Missouri. Both took a little different approach to addressing the OE, operational experience, but implemented corrective action almost immediately to that. Did I answer the question? Diablo's actions?
Yeah, so where did it end up, and why wasn't a proactive approach taken to prevent the same thing from happening?
Well, there was a proactive. It's a little bit more complicated, but there is was a proactive approach from our view. The OE was generated in 2005. Actions were taken in 2005 by Pacific Gas and Electric to ensure that the system was still capable of performing its function, and that was by making that procedural change to the emergency procedure for mitigating a loss of coolant accident to add the cooling water to the heat exchanger. So even though that didn't restore the margin to the motor operated valve, it did ensure that it would function and meet the minimum requirements in that interim period.
Yeah, the question is if they had tested the valve in 2006. So let's kind of replay it a little bit. So in 2005, Diablo Canyon received some operating experience from a plant back east that said the differential pressure across the containment sump outlet valve may be too high for the valve to operate properly. Diablo Canyon evaluated that operating experience and said, you know what, we might be vulnerable to the same condition
and they took a two-phase approach. The first step, if you remember, Dr. Peck earlier said they changed the emergency operating procedure to add cooling water to a heat exchanger to cool down the water in that segment of piping to prevent that differential pressure from occurring at, or reaching as high a value as it may have been able to. That, in the near term, essentially eliminated
valve, which unfortunately affect this other valve that was a discharge of the RHR heat exchanger. So the valve that we're here talking about today, which resulted in a degraded emergency core cooling system, was not the subject of the operational experience. It just happens to be an artifact of a fix that wasn't properly installed on this valve associated with the operating experience. Does that make sense?
The next, we have a couple of questions that involve cross-cutting issues. Michael, you want to take the cross-cutting issues?
Well, the team has recommended a cross-cutting aspect. Just let me back up a little bit. The NRC, as part of their inspection program, looks for causes or underlying causes of particular issues, findings, and violations that we review as part of the inspection process. And the intent of a cross-cutting issue is to identify those attributes that really address the underlying performance deficiency which leads to a problem. And in this case, as Mike Runyon had mentioned, that there's three proposed violations, and each of those proposed violations does have a cross-cutting aspect associated with it. The first violation was inadequate design control, and the team recommended a cross-cutting aspect of P1 Charlie. That's a little bit of code that we use, but basically what it's saying is that the inspectors felt that there's a less than adequate problem evaluation associated with the changes associated with this valve, which had with the underlying cause associated with it. The test control issue, the team assigned a cross-cutting aspect of P1 Alpha, again, code. The P1 Alpha basically means that the team felt that the licensee didn't enter a problem with a sufficient low threshold into the corrective action system. And that was really related to the testing attributes. As we talked about to the story about how we got to where we were at, after the valve was initially modified and tested, and the testing engineer identified that it couldn't meet its 25-second stroke time, we had an expectation that condition be entered into the corrective action system and documented as a failure to meet that post-modification testing. And so the P1 alpha basically corresponds to not maintaining a low enough threshold for entering the problem in the corrective action system. And finally, the 5059 violation, that has to do with the adequate evaluation of this change to the emergency procedures to add cooling water to the heat exchanger. So we would say that was indicative of a less than adequate problem evaluation, because it was a problem evaluation issue that really got the licensee into making these changes to begin with.
We had a question involving, does the NRC expect to apply a monetary penalty for the three violations that were identified? In this case, the two of the violations, the design control violation and the test control violation, those are assessed under our reactor oversight program, and those are assigned a significance, green, white, yellow, or red, based on the safety significance, and that's how those are being treated. There will be a public end of cycle meeting in the June time frame. Those types of findings are assessed as part of the annual review of plant performance. And because they were both of low safety significance or green, those are typically dispositioned by the utility, and then the NRC follows up on the corrective actions as part of their problem identification and resolution inspection activity. The third violation was a failure to do an evaluation to determine if prior NRC approval was needed for a modification to the facility. That's assessed under what we term our traditional enforcement process. Because the safety significance was very low, it was assigned a severity level of 4. Severity level 4 violations do not enter the monetary civil penalty process. Only severity level 3 or higher do. So the short answer is no, we will not be assessing a civil penalty for these findings. We had another question on when the clutch is disengaged. This is referring to the motor operated valve. How many pounds of pressure does it take to turn the sump manually? I refer to that as the hand wheel manually. And would a human have the capability to perform this amount of torque? A heat exchanger outlet valve as a mispositioning error. These were not mispositioning errors. This was a breakdown in the modification and testing process, which resulted in an interlock not being able to make up to allow a valve to be opened from the control room. But the valve was maintained in the correct position. We had another issue involving trends in cross-cutting issues. The types and number of cross-cutting issues that the facility has had documented in inspection reports will be evaluated as part of our assessment process. Our assessment evaluation is scheduled for mid-February, and the results of that will be communicated in the end-of-cycle public meeting, which is in June of 2010. Mike, I got a couple of questions involving the significance determinations. The first one relates to how do you judge human error and ignorance as part of the safety issues?
We use a human error analysis method that looks at both the operator's ability to diagnose what the problem is and what needs to be done, and also his or her ability to actually perform those actions. And for each of those separate issues, we look at what we call performance shaping factors, such as how much time did they have to do it? How much time would it have taken to do it? How much stress would they be under? Were the procedures good and clear? Did they have training? Were there ergonomic factors, man-machine issues that would have made it complex or difficult to do? So we judge each of those factors individually, and then we use a mathematical method to come up with the failure probability, and that's what we did in this case. We looked at the probability of operators failing to open the valves that couldn't be opened from the control room, and using this mathematical method, performance shaping factors, we came up with a less than 1% chance that they would fail.
I have a couple more cards here. Megan, I don't know. Are you still collecting cards out there? If you have others. So, we had a question that involves how many other modifications have been made by PG&E staff that have been considered maintenance activities instead of modifications in the design. And as we talked earlier during the business portion of the meeting, this is something that we expect Diablo Canyon to address as part of their corrective actions for the violations. So I can't give you a number of how many other modifications have been made that were considered maintenance activities, not today. I do know that our follow-up to Diablo Canyon's corrective actions to address these violations will consider how well they've addressed maintenance activities or field changes that should have been processed as part of the modification program. And related to the NRC follow-up, there's a question on, is the NRC taking actions or making any requirements to try to prevent recurrence of the combination of these three violations that we talked about today, design control, test control, and safety evaluations? And again, as part of our review of the corrective actions for the root causes behind these violations, we'll be evaluating actions taken by the facility to deal with improvements in the design control program. And Jeff has a question card that had a couple of pages attached to it to explain the questions, and I asked him to go through those and summarize those. So, Jeff, it's on you.
All right, I'll go through these. First question, I believe this has come from the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee meeting, or the root cause team leader had shared elements of the report, I believe the root cause report, at that meeting. The question deals with the, in that report, the team leader had mentioned that the a procedure change was made that caused the situation for the limits, basically for the failure to test the limit switches during the outage. And that the failure to test was an unintended consequence of that procedure change. And there were statements that are quoted here from the report about how that procedure change, it was basically a testing frequency change, was done to reduce outage hours and reduce the critical path time and or outage duration as a cost-cutting measure. The question is there a generic issue with activities performed infrequently as expressed at that committee meeting, and why was that particular comment made? I can't speak to the reasons behind why the comment was made as far as whether it was a generic issue with the infrequently performed procedures or infrequently performed activities.
The event did not adversely affect the health and safety of the public, so I'm going to get my risk analyst to handle that difference.
Okay, as I mentioned earlier, we did identify there was some risk involved in this event, but after we evaluated it, it was very, very small. The key word here is adversely. What we're looking at is we're kind of comparing the amount that this raised the average risk level at the plant. And when compared to the average risk level, this was a very small increase. And therefore, we didn't consider, the licensee did not describe it as an adverse effect on public safety. Obviously, yes, there was a minimal effect, but that effect was very, very small, as we discussed.
Okay, thanks. Next question, this came from the corrective actions that were initially identified for this event. It stated that an operation summary of the event was published and given to all crews, basically to conduct training on knowing locations of valves identified in emergency operating procedures that might be required to be manually operated using contactors at motor control centers. Condition involved in individual switch settings that were capable of functioning but were not properly coordinated to ensure operability. Does this mean that had there been an emergency, the crews would not have known the location of the switches in question, would not have been able to get to the correct location in time? And what does "were not properly coordinated to ensure operability" mean? This goes to, and I believe if I'm understanding the question correctly, for this particular event, the operators did know where the valves were that they had to go and manually operate. The issue of being not properly coordinated, I believe in Dr. Peck's discussion described the interaction between the switches inside the valve operator itself. There was the one rotor that stopped the valve from moving and a second that told the other valve, basically that the first valve was open and it could be operated. That the coordination between those was affected by the change that was made such that the one valve would not open electronically, but it was still capable of being opened locally. And the operator, the crews, all of the crews did know the locations of those valves and the procedure for manually operating them. Beyond that, I don't have the specifics on the operations summary here. Is there more to that that I've...
Well, I'll just mention that when the PG&E Pacific Gas and Electric first responded to the event, one of the actions that their root cause team did was ask a number of, I think there was three initially, operators to go act out at this procedure, basically to take the guidance that's in the emergency procedure and define the valve and take the action to manually open it. And I believe, and Mr. Becker can correct me if I'm mistaken here, but I believe the times that there was used for the subsequent safety analysis to trying to get a handle on the significance of this issue, used the longest of those times. So one operator took a little bit longer time than the other two to find it, but all of them knew where the valve was.
There is also an operator aid available to control room operators that would provide that location information if an operator didn't happen to know that location off the top of their head. It's not a valve that's typically visited on a routine basis by plant operations personnel.
Yes, I would agree with that.
The next question is a risk question. Discusses that at the meeting, a discussion of, as Mike Rennie mentioned, about the 70 minutes was the worst-case scenario time that was available for the operators to manipulate the valve. And the question is basically what would happen if it took, say, 73 minutes, or greater than 70 minutes?
If it took what, more than 70 minutes to open the valve. Okay.
70 minutes is the time that the reactor core would have had forced cooling going through it. If they had not opened the valve within 70 minutes, we're talking about the worst-case condition now. In a lot of the cases, they have way more than 70 minutes, but let's suppose they didn't get it done. Then the high and intermediate head pumps would have stopped. There would have been no force cooling through the reactor. And during this time, the reactor would start to heat up and pressurize. So there would be some additional time that the plant could still recover from this event. Exactly how much time that is depends on the specific scenarios. But there would have been some additional time. So I'm saying if it had been 73 versus 70, probably not a problem. And how far beyond that, it's hard for me to say unless I could look at the actual situation directly.
But I believe it's fair to say that 70 minutes was a fairly conservative number anyway.
Well, worst case.
Yeah, it was a worst case.
Next question states, was the appropriate test performed? If not, why not? And was it recorded as having been performed? This, I believe, went over in the scenario of events. This is the subject of two of the violations that we issued. The appropriate test, if I'm reading this correctly, being the test that would have verified that the interlock switches would have worked and the valves would be able to respond to this. Either an individual from the control room or one of the building operators would be able to go to perform the manual operations. They are all trained in operating the equipment, so they would be familiar and able to do that. And that's at all hours, anytime the plant's operating 24 hours. So they do have the staff available for this and would be familiar with that operation. And the next question, the root cause report indicated that the root cause was a deficient procedure used to adjust the limit switchers. The procedure was a motor-operated valve test that allows a limit switch adjustment but provides no substantive guidance on how to do it or what to do or what to consider regarding rotor coordination. The question was, does anyone look over tests of this nature before they go into use in real situations first to make sure there is enough guidance to do the job? Yeah, because this one slipped through, could there be others as well?
When we talked about the root cause evaluation, our assessment, the inspection team's assessment of the root cause evaluation, we talked about the team believing that there was concluding there was an opportunity for improvement. And part of that was that distinction between post-maintenance and post-modification. When the Pacific Gas and Electric completed their root cause evaluation, they were looking at this as a maintenance activity. But the maintenance activity only allowed them to restore the limit switch settings to those particular set points which are specified in plant design documents. In this case, it was our view that that procedure would not have allowed them to reset those limit switches to correct this problem. Our view was that the design process had to be re-entered so that a new set point for the limit, the rotor 3 limit switch had to be established, and then that would be set back into motion as a modification to the plant. And then part of that plant modification process would also specify post-modification testing, which would then verify this interaction between the rotor 3 limit switch and the heat exchanger outlet valve was in fact functioning. So in summary, this was a discrepancy that the team felt they identified within the Pacific Gas and Electric root cause evaluation.
And the next question states that at the Independent Safety Committee meeting on December 10th, a root cause team leader indicated that it would take 20 to 25 minutes to open the valves after noting the switch was after it didn't operate. But in the binder provided by Pacific Gas and Electric, it said 15 minutes. Why was there a discrepancy? I don't know why there was a discrepancy between the two, between what was in the binder and what was stated, but the NRC inspection team did confirm that it would take about 20 minutes, so 20 minutes was the appropriate time frame. And that was all for...
Thanks, Jeff. We had two questions that go back to the reactor coolant system fluid being radioactive and what the projected exposure to an employee would be that had to go out and operate those valves. So, Mike, you want to address that? Okay.
We did do a calculation, also the licensee, and we compared results. And the maximum exposure we would have expected for the operators opening these valves would have been about 500 millirem at the very outside, one rem. And licensee procedures authorize an exposure up to 10 rem to perform this type of action. So the radioactivity of the fluid would have been contained within the containment building or within the system piping. It would not have directly impinged upon the operators, and the radiation levels would have been within the limits allowed.
And then, Mike, this one's also for you in regards the licensee event report again and the reference to a number of design changes that are in the licensee event report.
This refers to a number of LERs that were, or a number of design changes that were made in the sequence of events that led up to this condition. And during our inspection, we developed a detailed sequence of events that went all the way back to 2005. So we did consider all of these design changes and all of the activities that occurred between 2005 and in the present time. So this was considered in our inspection.
And then the last card I have now, unless Megan, unless you have more to bring up. But the last card, the question is it up to each plant to address operating experience applicability to their plants, systems slash design, or is there NRC oversight or mandates? Specifically operating experience bulletins for corrective actions. Every licensee is required to have a program that monitors the network for operating experience. Operating experience comes in a variety of different manners. It can come directly from another utility. It can come from industry. No, that's not it.
Okay, it deals with the shoreline fault.
And yeah, there was a question. Is that what you're referring to, the shoreline fault? Since we didn't have Annie on the phone anymore, I was going to get back to you with contact information. The question was the analysis of the shoreline fault will be finalized over the next year. Why then try to relicense this year? Again, the license renewal meeting is coming up in a couple of weeks. That's a great question for those guys. We'll make sure they get it so they can address it during the license renewal meetings, and we'll pass this along to Annie to get a better answer on the analysis of the shoreline fault when they're projecting completion of that review and get it back to you.
I think at this point we would.
Oh yeah. All right, yeah, I didn't see that one. Has the NRC addressed any other violations at any time concerning issues where a design change had been treated as a maintenance issue? If so, how many times? And again, I can't get you specific numbers tonight. Michael or Jeff, do you have a perspective on design change issues? Design control violations occur with some frequency across all the nuclear power plants. There's quite a few. In order to maintain a facility, there's a number of modifications that are made at each facility each year, some of them to address parts obsolescence issues where you have to find new parts to replace parts that are no longer available. Those all require modifications. And we do find it's not uncommon to have design control violations at any of the nuclear power facilities.
Okay.
Was the question specific to Diablo Canyon?
Right, that's in terms of a maintenance field change that bypasses the design control process, that's not a typical form of a design control violation. We don't see as many of those, and that's why we wanted to especially call that out and grab Diablo Canyon's attention to that, because those types of things that bypass programs give us more concern. And so we would expect them to give that a lot of attention in their implementation of corrective actions, and that would get some level of focus from the agency in a follow-up review.
I'll just add that the team concluded that the design control process had sufficient rigor to have prevented this from happening, the end result from happening, had it been fully implemented.
There's another question. I hadn't had a time to look at this yet. So will the valves be operable during or in the immediate aftermath of an earthquake with damage? Would this valve opening problem be of low significance if it occurred during an earthquake? Again, this particular valve is designed to withstand the maximum probable earthquake in the licensee's accident analysis. We would not expect to see any damage to motor-operated valves as a result of an earthquake. So we would expect the operators to still be able to open this valve. Yes, sir.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. The question was, this was rated as low significance, which it seems like probably it is. But had the circumstances been different, would it be low significance if you couldn't operate them electronically, which is part of the question that you haven't read yet, or if you had to do it manually and people are dead? There's rubble. You can't get to the things. And it seems likely to me that there might be damage, but I won't dispute that with you. The question is, the core of this whole issue is that question of operability. I'm not talking about the likelihood of a tsunami right now, and I'm not talking about the likelihood of an earthquake. I'm saying if those things happen, incident.
Let me get the easy part of that first, and that's the inspection report. It's in the review stages right now, and just process wise, we need to do the exit first. We did the exit, and then we have 45 days by our own internal metrics to get the report out. But we expect to see the report come out the end of February, and then it'll be available for review. I want to get back to the earthquake question. Diablo Canyon's designed to withstand certain magnitudes of an earthquake. That's the design basis earthquake for the facility. Plant equipment and structures are designed to be able to withstand an earthquake up to that magnitude. So we would expect, this being a safety-related component, that it would still be able to function electronically. In this case, because of the rotor one interface, that electronic part was defeated, but the operator still would have been able to make their way to the valve because of the robustness of the structures of the safety-related buildings and open the valve.
That's the hope in any case.
We believe the facility will operate as designed. Yeah.
By the way, on this question of flood, she made an answer and she said it's above the flood stage or something like that. And you look at the photos, and including where the dry storage is, it doesn't look very much above anything. And I think that the actual, where the reactor is maybe 40, 50 feet above sea level, admittedly. So it's, when these tsunamis, there was one in Alaska that went 1,700 feet up the side of a enclosed canyon. And that canyon that the reactor goes back up into and where the dry casks are and so forth, that's a conduit. That's a watershed, and it's a conduit in reverse. So that water will go right up there. I mean, all you have to do is look at the pictures. So this business about, I was told at the safety meeting that the dry cask area is supposedly 300 or 400 feet above sea level, and it's hard for me to see that. But when I look at a picture, it's hard for me to see that. It doesn't seem that high to me. That's beyond the purview of this, but it is part of this whole question of way 15 years early renewing a license that probably couldn't be gotten today. So thank you.
Well, I'll pass the tsunami question on to the license renewal folks, number one. But two, we'll go back and take a look at that, the design basis tsunami event, and take a look at the elevations at the facility and try to get you an answer back. It's unless you know firsthand.
Back when the plant was being originally licensed, the maximum, basically, people that do this for a living looked at the underwater topography. They looked at the structures of the canyon. They looked at the cove, inlet cove, and I believe the maximum flood height from a tsunami is about 32 feet, 36 feet, sometimes in some of that range. And the equipment that can be potentially affected by that type of water level, it tests about salt water pumps and that provide emergency cooling in the inlet bay, are structured to be protected from a tsunami if one should occur. The plant itself sits up on the hill, and the spent fuel storage is up way up on the hill. So it from an elevation perspective, it's way out of the zone that would be potentially affected by the tsunami. And just to reiterate, the equipment that is within that tsunami range has engineering features that protect it from that tsunami. It's in concrete, watertight structures with huge snorkels that come up 30 some feet out of the structure to provide ventilation to it above that maximum potential flooding area.
I think at this point I'd like to move on so we can get some other questions or comments. We'd like to get your contact information. Maybe we can have some additional discussion with you at a later time. I would ask that the additional questions or comments, we'd like to keep it related to the topic of the meeting. Otherwise, we may just have to take your questions and get back to you at a later time.
Sure. Yes, could have put this on a card, but I just thought of it. When PG&E and the NRC separately and together evaluated this problem, was the time pressure taken into account? Whenever there's an outage, we read the public announcements, the public relations, whatever, press releases from PG&E saying they have a goal of completing this outage. And
I'm just a little unclear on that whole issue. I mean, it seems like the root of the root cause is, you know, this person wouldn't have taken this adjustment, you know, wouldn't be necessary unless these differential pressures didn't happen. And was that done on all Westinghouse plants, this new, you know, emergency cooling modifications?
Can I use the visual aid? I'm going to need a
system schematic.
I really need to show a picture to explain this. But basically, let me go back a little bit further here. For small, I talked about the different types of loss of coolant accidents that can occur. And for those types of loss of coolant accidents, we call it small break loss of coolant accident, the reactor basically stays pressurized. And as a result of that, the low head system, we also call it the RHR system, is operating at a discharge pressure less than the pressure of the reactor coolant system. So what happens is it basically just sits on a recirc. The recirc line isn't shown in this drawing, but the pump pumps through, comes back down here, and just continually cycles through. Well, what happens is like any type of large rotating equipment, the pump generates a certain amount of friction as it goes through, works the fluid. And that friction causes heat. And that heat causes the section to pressurize. And we typically use a rule of thumb about 100 pounds per degree. So as it tends to heat up, it tends to pressurize up to the point. Now again, it's not shown on this diagram, but there's a relief valve on the suction line, and that relief valve sits at a nominal 450 pounds. So if this system, if you make the assumption that it's airtight, it's completely filled, and sits there and operates in this recirc mode, the pump heat will eventually work that system, that fluid, to the point where it would pressurize to 450 pounds and that relief valve would open. So the original operational experience basically said that, hey, nuclear industry, be aware that that this particular condition can occur. Now there's another program that goes back to the late 80s, and it asked all licensees to evaluate all their motor-operated valves and make a determination on the maximum pressure that valve has to operate against. And part of that program was to ensure that it had the adequate capability, the adequate switch settings and that type of thing to function at that pressure. And typically, this sump valve was determined to have to operate at about a maximum of 60 pounds. So we have a difference now between the design value of 60 pounds differential pressure and now a new condition under these certain circumstances which can result in 450 pounds that it has to open up against. And the valve is just not sized for it. It just physically doesn't have the capability to open up that against that pressure.
So I'm still a little confused. Why wasn't that recirc mode that caused the higher pressure, why wasn't that foreseen as an original design condition? Was that a change that was made to all the Westinghouse plants at some point?
It was basically a discovery of an unknown condition. It was something new that wasn't expected in the design. Now there's some assumptions that go with that, and these are very conservative assumptions. One of the assumptions, and I mentioned this earlier, is that this piping has to be completely void of air. Now when operations fills and vents a system, they do a pretty good job of removing all we call condensable gases, but the air out of the system. But it's not perfect, and if there's any condensable compressible gases that are left in the system, in other words, air, then that's going to absorb this expansion and reduce the amount of heating. Now, as I mentioned, also just to backtrack a little bit, there's several different approaches to this problem. At Callaway plant in Missouri, they replaced this with a very large operator that could operate against 450 pounds pressure. At Wolf Creek, another plant similar to Diablo Canyon, they changed their design so that their accident signal, as soon as the emergency core cooling system got a signal to start automatically, it would also automatically open the valves to this heat exchanger to provide cooling water to it, again to mitigate the system. At Diablo Canyon, they basically used a combination of those two approaches.
Next.
Okay, there was one question that you answered, but you didn't really address the main question. The period between outages where that was not working properly. There's just recently, on September 1st, 2009, the inspectors identified that fire door 155 was inoperable because of the external latching mechanism device was not engaged, and then that was fixed, supposedly, but then on September 16th, which is just a couple of weeks later, the inspectors again identified that same door was inoperable because the external latching mechanism was not engaged. So as a result of that, you want me to hold it? you know, it and it talks about the fact that it was human error again, et cetera. It seems like every time we go to the Independent Safety Committee meetings, we see time after time after time that these problems occur, reoccur, and then there's more training, and it just keeps happening. And my question is sort of, you know, what do we do about this? Because it just doesn't seem to get a lot better. And then I have a second question, which has to do with the seismic issue. She said that 3D mapping was, in fact, going to be part of the final analysis. If that's true, then why is PG&E going to the PCUC to ask ratepayers to pay for the 3D mapping study? That's the next question. And then my final thing is, when will the license renewal meeting be held? Is it going to be the same night as the Independent Safety Council, and will it be publicized this time? Thank you.
For the license renewal meeting, I think it came to our attention today that there was a conflict with another meeting, maybe, and so we're looking at that license renewal meeting date to try to pick a more optimum time if possible. The seismic 3D mapping and what PG&E is doing in terms of getting funding for that, I can't answer that question for PG&E, but I'll pass it along to Annie to see if she can give us some insights as to how that's being funded on, since she said it was going to be performed, so I can try to get you some feedback on that. And then the first part of it, I'm not 100%, I might need some clarification here on what the question involves. Does it involve the frequency of issues that are occurring at Diablo, and what's the NRC doing? Due to human error, and what the NRC is doing to oversee that, or
and the same events repeated. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So I know with respect to human error issues or issues that involve corrective action programs, we treat those as cross-cutting issues, and we heard some dialogue earlier this evening and questions about cross-cutting issues. We roll those up periodically, and if we see a trend, an adverse trend in cross-cutting issues, be they human error related or corrective action program related, we will then characterize those as a substantive cross-cutting issue or a substantive problem, and we expect the licensees to perform analyses of those types of problems, develop a corrective action plan, and then we come out and periodically assess that during our inspection program. So I know that roll-up of the previous year's human errors and errors involving the corrective action program is currently underway, and once we finish that, then we'll make a determination as to whether or not we need to characterize those as a substantive cross-cutting problem. I do know that in the last assessment cycle, we had some concerns with respect to problem evaluation. Those concerns were shared with the licensee. We expected the licensee was also aware of those concerns, entered that into their corrective action process, and developed a plan to start addressing those issues. Part of our roll-up review that's undergoing right now will assess whether or not the licensee has been successful in dealing with those problems. So I don't have the whole story for you tonight, but at the end of the cycle meeting, when these guys come back in the June time frame, they should have the whole story for you.
Can I ask just a follow-up question?
Yeah.
When we were at the Independent Safety Council committee meeting, they said that they have an average of 50 corrective action items each day that come through. So that's quite a number of corrective actions. How many do you deal with in the course of the year, would you say?
8,000 corrective action documents entered. And as I said, we reviewed 100. Between Tony and myself, we reviewed 100% of those.
Any other questions or comments? I think we have one back.
Thank you for coming, gentlemen. I have a question that wasn't really answered with the card. It was actually the first question. It was about the 9 Richter earthquake. Now, that's in very simplistic terms, since I represent a town that's 10 miles away, as the wind flows, maybe 15 minutes away in time, what is the plant, in one sentence, rated for on a Richter scale seismic event? Can you please answer that?
The Hawsgray earthquake fault, I believe, is predicted to generate a magnitude 7.5. Does that sound right, Tony? And that's a ground acceleration of about 0.74 G.
And that's the bounding.
Well, it's not bounding in each case. For the most part, yes.
I would like to follow that up by saying that's a prediction based on models that have occurred through history. Is that correct, with the history of those faults having previous earthquakes at that intensity? Or is that just some – where did you get that figure?
Well, I didn't get it at all. We're not the right people to – we rely on experts, people that do that for a living. What we do is we take the results of that analysis and we ensure that the safety-related component systems in that are, in fact, built to specifications so they can withstand that. How that's generated is somebody else's job. We don't...
Slightly nervy of me. The number 7.5 came from the United States Geological Survey, and we know that because Mothers for Peace tried very hard to stop the original licensing of this plant, and seismicity was one of our big issues. So we studied that, and the gentleman, I'd like to meet you later.
I guess my question is a follow-up. Is that the magnitude that was used as design criteria for the plant? Is that your answer? I'm not quite sure. Anyone?
Yeah, that's what's described in the facility safety analysis report as the design basis earthquake event. So that's my understanding. But I would have to go back to the FSAR and pull that up to get you the. To make sure that's the correct answer.
There's a number of seismic events. There's a safe shutdown, an operational shutdown, the Hawsgray long-term seismic program that all generate basically ground movement spectra. And the plant's required to be designed to meet all those conditions.
Any other questions, comments?
Well, I see that Mr. Becker is here from Diablo Canyon, and he, like Brett Favre, he's the quarterback, but he has to do all the blocking, too. I think he knows that, probably would know what it's designed for. That was the question that the gentleman had.
All right, Mr. Becker.
Yeah, we didn't want to impose on Mr. Becker since it was an NRC meeting, but if he wants to jump in and help me out here, I'll...
So unlike Brett Favre, when I decide to retire, that's going to be it. Actually, Michael, I think, answered the question accurately. So, yeah, the Hosgri earthquake fault is part of the design basis of the plant. So the plant is designed to withstand the earthquake that Michael described on the Hosgri fault. That is part of the seismic design basis of the plant. That's an accurate answer.
What is that number?
It is a 7.5. That is my recollection. The 7.5 Richter scale. That is my recollection.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions, comments? Okay. I'm going to turn it over to the board.
All right. Well, I appreciate the turnout. It's obviously you are a very well-informed public, and you ask very good, tough questions. I appreciate the participation and the opportunity to speak in front of you tonight. So with that, I think we'll...